I guess I'll basically go back to the beginning of this because I rushed at the end last time. So the scheme is you have you produce an entangled pair of particles over here. Over here you have the system that you want to teleport. Perform a certain measurement on the on this particle and this one. And then you get a classical outcome from this measurement. You communicate that classical information to the other end from a unit tree. So this is the result of this is some result k equals 0, 1, 2, 3, or four possible results. Then you perform a unit tree here. Depends on k. And when you do that, the particle that comes out the upper end is in the same state as the one that you sent in. Notice, so I'll go through how this works, but notice that you have to send classical information from one end to the other. So this means that it's not instantaneous, unlike many accounts of this you see in the press. So this has to be, this is cannot be faster than the speed of light. Call this system A1, A2, A3, A4. Define these states. These are the Bell states. So those are four states. They're orthogonal to each other, or orthonormal states, and they span the basis of these two qubits. First of all, we prepare this one here in one of the four states. It doesn't really matter which, but simply if you take phi plus. Then here we make a measurement on so the basis indicated by these four states.
So the difference is on E we always perform the measurement with phi plus, but on B with any of the four states.
Yeah, because this is a measurement that has outcomes, so you don't know what the outcome is going to be, but so it has to be, but you know, like a measurement is associated with a set of basis states. Any set of basis states, you can perform a measurement that projects onto those.
Without measurement, it collapsed to one of those 0, 0, 1, 1, one of those states, or
yeah, it would collapse onto one of these four states. Or there's here. So the initial state is well, you have some state of the qubit coming in. And you don't know what that state is. So we'll indicate it by alpha 0 plus beta 1. And then these two particles are in prepared in this entangled state. And this is equal to, and I'm just going to write down this and leave it as an exercise for you to check if this is true. Plus four terms in total. So to check this, you can just substitute in these expressions in here, multiply everything out, and you'll see that a whole bunch of terms cancel. So you get this. It's trivial, but just takes a few minutes to check it. So now, if you measure in the Bell basis, that's the basis for particles A1 and A2, and you'll get one of these four terms. Okay. If you project, after you've made the measurement, you'll get one of the four terms. Now, if let's say this one is the k equals zero result. So if you get that result, then your state, particle three, is already in the correct state. You don't have to do anything. That means the unitary transformation in this case is just the identity. So U 0 well, this is for first term. If you get this here, then this is almost the right state. Just got a minus sign there. And you can easily put that right by a unitary. So the unitary that does that is this. So if you do that, if you apply that unitary here, then you get the correct state coming out. If you get the third term, put it on here, psi plus, then you have to flip 1 and 0. And the unitary that does that is right around is, yeah, that. So this is. You have that. In this case, you just want to flip the 1 and 0. And if you get the fourth result, then you want to both flip the 1 and 0 and also change the phase. And then you've successfully teleported the state. Yeah, go ahead.
A couple of questions.
Yeah, go ahead.
Using. So, first of all, what does that zero, lower index A1 or A2 or A3, what does that mean exactly? Or one?
Which one here? This.
Yeah.
This qubit, each of these qubits, I maybe should have said that, is spanned by a two-dimensional Hilbert space. It belongs to a two-dimensional Hilbert space. A3, for example, and A3, you can specify Hilbert space by fact.
Like we have three particles, each of them have its own two-dimensional Hilbert space.
That's right, we have 1, 2, 3, and yeah, each one has its own two-dimensional Hilbert space.
Okay.
And they're spanned by the 0, 1 states. That's good.
And over that unitary transformation, what does exactly happen physically? It's like one particle goes in and the information.
Yeah. And then you could think of it as being the same particle comes out.
Okay. We want the same particle.
Well, identity in quantum theory is. But let's just say it's the same particle that goes in that comes out, because you know, otherwise you could imagine some box that absorbs this particle and spits another particle out, but only after transferring the state of this one to this one. But we don't need to do that. We can just have the same particle goes in and goes out.
That information is another state or particle or something, or
which information?
K01.
This is now classical information, so you could broadcast it on the radio. You could, you know, any form of classical communication.
So it's like a machine has four different styles, right? And depending on the K value.
Yeah, so this unitary will take one of four possible. Probably depending on that. So you wait for this information to arrive here, and then decide depending on what you get, implement that. Any more questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Why is there four different classical options? Is there like four different bases you could measure in?
So it's because you have. You do this Bell state measurement, and there's four possible outcomes here, and then you know so that then corresponds to the four terms.
Okay.
Yeah. So maybe there's a few comments on this. Please go ahead. Yeah.
I don't understand how physically we can produce that state. Like our initial state is that alpha 0 plus beta 1. And
yeah.
E is producing some Bell state phi plus, and then you're saying that the initial state that enters B is that? That's why, like.
The initial state that comes in here is the same as the state that goes out here, yeah. I mean, it is striking, and it's surprising in some sense. It can work, but it does work because of the machinery Hilbert space. You can check this calculation.
So the big picture is that we are taking the Bell states of particle 2 and 3, tensored with a normal state of particle 1, and that is equal to Bell states of particle 1 and 2, tensor all particle three states? Is that
this thing here? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this unknown state with just one of the Bell states is equal to this superposition.
I think maybe the thing that I'm not understanding is the same that how, like, when we're sending through the channel A2 and A1, like through particle A1 and A2,
mm-hmm.
like we're taking the state of particle A2 and the initial state of particle A1, how that phi plus is A2, A3 is?
No, I don't. How that?
Like, how can we?
So you send out, these two particles are entangled in a certain state. These two particles are not entangled. But you make a measurement onto an entangled basis.
So what E is actually doing is that it's sending two entangled particles and
yeah.
one of them is the
yeah. So one reason this is surprising, I think I've got two comments. There's many things you can say about this, but one reason this is surprising is because when you send in here you send in this state, and there's two real numbers. Okay, so to specify this state requires two real numbers. So in some sense, an infinite amount of classical information is required to specify this state, or at least an arbitrarily large amount of classical information if you want to do it up to some given accuracy. So you have a large amount of information coming here on the state. This entanglement can be previously shared, so it doesn't communicate any information. And here you would think, here you just send just one of four possible classical states. So that's two classical bits. It's just two classical bits of information is sufficient to communicate, it would seem, an infinite amount of information which is contained in the alpha and beta. And that's quite strange. Now, you can't actually use this. You see, you can't actually use this to set up a classical channel that communicates an infinite amount of information, because it's not possible to extract from the state when you get it out the other end an arbitrarily large amount of information. There's theorems that say basically you can only extract one classical bit of information from here. There is a way of getting two classical bits of information in a slightly different scheme, which I don't have notes on, called quantum dense coding. But you can't actually send an infinite amount of. So that's one comment. I had a second comment, which I don't remember now. Oh yeah, I mentioned this yesterday, but just to reiterate it, it's possible that this particle is itself entangled with something else, some arbitrary entangled state, say some preparation. Okay, it could be any particle, it could be a different kind of particle, and so the state of that would now be. Delta just anyway, some arbitrary state, so let's call it like that, this is meant to be an arbitrary state between this new particle I've just introduced, B5 and A1. Okay. And if you do teleportation now, then what will happen is afterwards, the state you get out will be the same as this state, just the particle will change, of course. So the entanglement will be preserved. You've swapped the entanglement from being between this particle and this one, being between this particle and this one. And that kind of has to work because quantum theory is linear. Each of these, so the teleportation process is effectively linear. I'm just going to give you a few words around this, not prove this rigorously. So each of the terms in the superposition for this state will be linearly affected. And if you go through, you can see everything is linear. And so it really has to work. Right. So this is entanglement swapping. I recommend strongly to you the original paper on quantum teleportation. So it's a Physical Review Letters. It's 4 pages long. It's got a lot of stuff in I haven't mentioned.
Being signaling to you in a time-like manner, right? So like we don't have any light signal.
Yeah, this is at light. It cannot be faster than light. Yeah. So there's no way you can teleport faster than the speed of light using this or any other scheme that I'm aware of. Since I have it in my notes, let me just draw the diagram for quantum dense coding. It's in some sense, it's the sort of dual idea. So you share the same entangled state. Now you have two classical bits of information coming in. And what you do is you on one of these two qubits, you put a unitary transformation according to one of these two classical bits you have. Okay. And then you take this qubit and send it over here. And now you perform a Bell measurement like that. Okay. So this U will convert this psi this phi plus into one of the 4 Bell states.
Okay.
According to the classical information you have coming here. And then out here you can decode that classical information from here. And so you get the same classical information out as you put in. So if this is K goes in, then K comes out. Okay. And what's maybe striking about that is that you're able to do that by only sending, so this entanglement can be previously shared the day before. So you're only sending one qubit, and the qubit only seems to have, you know, has a 0 and a 1 state inside it. So you're able to send 2 classical bits using one qubit. So that's perhaps striking. And you can see how it kind of fits in with what happens over here. It ties together nicely with this, if I raise. If you read the teleportation paper, they use these two experiments to kind of put limits on each other. Bounds. So you can see, for example, you could replace qubit with a teleportation inside here. You could break this qubit up and teleport a teleportation inside here. Then you'd have 2 qubits. Qubits gets converted into 2 classical bits inside. So you can play some games. And in the paper, they talk about bounds.
Communication.
Yeah, go ahead.
On the amount of information being able to be passed through one qubit, or could we send like arbitrarily more information through larger entangled states?
The bounds are on the amount of information you can pass through one qubit. You can't get more than 2 classical bits using one qubit in a kind of scheme like this. I mean, there's other stuff you can do which where you can make a qubit behave like it has an infinite amount of classical information on it, but that's not this kind of send and receive type.
But this is only for spin-off systems, right? Like
Yeah, but all of this, so all of this works perfectly well if you go to arbitrary dimension. You just have to define a bigger set of Bell states, of entangled states, which you can do. So it's very very easy to generalize this to arbitrarily high dimension.
Can we send three classical bits as one qubit if you're working with spin one systems?
So three classical bits. Oh, right. The limit is if you have two qubits, which is a four-dimensional Hilbert space, then you can get four classical bits. Then you get four classical bits. Yeah, and I think that's right. If you have a spin one, which is a Q-trit, modern quantum information, then you get one of three classical bits. Okay. Right. Let me move on to a new quantum effect. So this will be the quantum Zeno effect. Okay, so here's the idea. You have a system in some initial state. Zero. Now we evolve that system through some small time. Like so. And now we can expand that as we can expand this as 1 plus I there's going to be higher order terms as well. Okay. After this small amount of time, most of the amplitude is still in zero. There's a small amplitude for the state to be different from zero. And now we perform a projective measurement to see if the state is in zero or not in zero. Thank you. that's the projector acts, projects down to the zero state. And then I'm imagining here we have an n-dimensional Hilbert space. So the states go, the basis we're looking at this in goes from 0 up to n minus 1. So this is the project, we're making a projector measurement either x onto this or this one. You add those two together, you get the identity. Okay. So the probability associated with this one, this projector, well, you can see from here, and I'll do a slightly more careful calculation in a moment, but you can see from looking at this that it pertains to this term here, and it's going to go as t squared. So some positive constant. And then delta t squared. Yeah, go ahead.
The first state is definitely a zero, but the second state can be a superposition of both zero and non-zero states.
Yeah, so I'll do the calculation now because this one is I want to show where you get this k squared from. I think it was when I gave this lecture a few years back, someone asked a question like that. And make some notes which are here. Okay. So to do the calculation properly, what we want to do is take this state here. So that's the probability, that's the answer we're looking for. So this is equal to this. And then we substitute in what we have here. Sorry, this is, I made a mistake there. That's the thing we're trying to calculate. Okay. And now we can substitute in these approximate forms for psi of t. that. And now we can see that these parts here just disappear because we're projecting with n and there's no n equal to zero term. And so what we're left with is this times this. I'll just write down the answer. We have minus times a plus, and then I squared minus one, so we get a plus. And then we have delta t squared coming in. And now we have an h bar squared. Okay, and this is just the complex conjugate of that. So what we really have is and it's a sum of n. I lost. So that's the thing we get. And so it's true that the sum, not all of this side is in the some of the psi is in the some of this will have a zero basis, but nevertheless we get a constant times delta t squared. Okay, so this wrote down here is correct, and the constant is now given to you. So this result is striking. Well, actually, this means the probability of P0 is equal to 1 minus this sum a squared times delta t squared. So I'll explain why this result is striking. So first of all, so there's no linear term in k squared, in delta t squared. We have a quadratic term. And contrast that with classical processes. So for example, consider classical exponential decay. So here you'd have the probability of not decaying is equal to some exponential. And there's a characteristic time tau. So you get linear term here. And classical decay processes are like that, whereas quantum decay processes have this quadratic term. And this is everything I did here was extremely generic. There was no wasn't considering a special case. Yeah, go ahead.
So, can you understand it like a unique property of quantumness? Because Because it doesn't mean that every classical decay should follow with an explosion decay.
Oh no, there could be other. There could be other ones. I think under some kind of general assumptions, you could prove that classical processes decay like this. Give an example. I'm sure if you can probably make classical systems decay as a square of delta t, but I suspect you'd have to violate some kind of Markovian assumptions. Then I don't have a proof of that. Maybe I'll think of a proof.
Like the difference between this and that just comes out from what we define the measurement to be. Like there, we needed to project it and like. Yeah.
And
just comes out from projection, so like
yeah, well, it comes out from.
Should we use the same definition of measurement and then like?
It's not just that you project, but you also have to take the square. Like you get basically amplitudes get squared to give you probabilities, because you were hitting it from both sides, whereas in classical probability theory that's not what happens. So I haven't really explained why this is surprising yet. I'm just
So what is the word before decay?
Say again, sorry.
What is the word before decay?
Exponential. Okay. So this is really an aside. Let's go back to looking at the quantum case. This effect leads to the quantum Zeno effect. And let me explain how the quantum Zeno effect works. So the idea is you keep measuring, you have a system and you keep measuring it after short time delta t. You measure it after time delta t, then after 2 delta t, and then 3 delta t, and you keep repeating the measurement. And so what is the probability that the system hasn't is still in the zero state after you've done this many times? So if we do this, we have some total time divided by the short interval, because we're repeating this over and over again. So this is the total number of times. What's the probability of the system not having still being in the zero state after that? After time t. Well, that's equal to the probability of it being in the zero state after each one then multiplied together. So it's this, the power of the number of times. the measurement. Is that clear? And that is equal to 1 minus E over, we can just take the first term here, that equal to 1 minus T A squared delta T. And so what this means is if you make delta T sufficiently small, then this will go to zero. Okay, and so the probability goes to one. And so if you keep looking at the system, it never decays. This would be very surprising if you thought that looking was not disturbing. You know, in classical physics, you imagine you can look at a system without changing its state. You just happen to be looking. Whereas in quantum theory, that's not the case. Looking actually disturbs the system. And so this effect, the quantum Zeno effect, because Zeno had lots of paradoxes, similar flavor. It's also sometimes called the quantum watched pot effect. But yeah, go ahead.
Can we say that if we look at the system again and again for capital T time,
Capital T over delta times. So capital T is a number of some number of seconds, and delta T is a small time.
Number of times is capital T over delta T.
Yeah.
Then it becomes equivalent to a classical exponentially decaying system.
Well, in a sense,
because it's linear in delta.
Oh, because this is linear. I see what you're saying. Because it's linear in T, you're thinking. And I suppose that's true. That it's like behaving there like a classical system. But this is where you've looked many, many times. Yeah. I mean, I guess you could say that. I'm not sure if it's a good thing. One thing I emphasize, of course, so people often talk about exponential decay for atoms, I think, and that's true that you see these exponential laws. But actually, if you look on a sufficiently small time scale, atoms do decay because they're quantum systems. There will be some initial square, although the decay is exponential. If you make measurements over a very short time, then it isn't square initially. It isn't exponential initially. It's a very small correction to that. Okay. Any more?
Say it this way: when we make measurements in a very short time,
mm-hmm.
I don't let the system evolve.
Yeah. You kind of freeze the system. You can't evolve.
Acts like classical system.
Except with a classical system, if you make measurements, it will evolve still, because those measurements don't disturb the system. In S, the measurements do disturb the system. If you have some big classical process and you're just looking with your eyes, then it won't disturb
system.
Will decay in a linear fashion. So I think we discussed this a bit, but it's related to the fact that evolution is linear in Hilbert space, and yet we take squares amplitudes to get probabilities. Quantum theory has this property, it's a remarkable property, that even if you have a finite dimensional Hilbert space, so a finite number of possible distinguishable situations, you have a continuous set of pure states in the space. So let me explain this. So here's the classical case. So imagine we have a classical system that can be in one of three states. So it has probability one, so being in state one, and so on. Then the space of states would look like this. So if these three probabilities add up to one, then you have to be in this surface somewhere, in this triangle.
Okay.
The pure states are the ones at this corner. So pure states are ones that you cannot regard as being probabilistic mixtures of other states. So here's a pure state. Each of these pure states cannot be regarded as a mixture of other states. Whereas states on here, even on the edge here, you can think of it as being a probabilistic mixture of these pure states. If you want to evolve from one pure state to another pure state, then you really have to jump. And if you write down some transition matrix, that's going to lead to a probability which is linear in time, jumping. You could probably hack it so that it was square of some delta t. That would really involve cheating in some way, introducing another classical system. So, but under some reasonable assumptions, if you just have the state. Like this, then you evolve this by hitting it with a matrix. Well, then it's gonna have to jump into these other states. So it's a different kind of process. This I'm not saying anything rigorous here, but I think a rigorous. Okay. Now let's look at the quantum state space. So now I'm going to consider a spin half particle. And let's consider the probability getting spin up along the x direction, the y direction, and the z direction. And so the question is, what does the space of states look like now? Does anyone know the answer to that question? Apart from you, because I told you. Are you familiar with the block ball? Yeah, okay. So the block ball is a ball which is centered on the origin of your coordinate system. then you choose special coordinates. Here instead, we have different coordinates than the ones that are usually used for the block ball, but they're linearly related. And so you have a ball, and the ball, I'm going to draw, first of all, I'm going to draw a unit cube, one. Okay. So that's a unit cube. And now we take a ball and place it so that it fits just inside that unit cube.
Okay.
My best artistic rendition of that. Sometimes people do this, don't they? Okay, so there's a ball just inside the unit cube. And this is the space of allowed states for a qubit or for a spin half particle. So the states have to either be on the surface on the sphere or inside the ball. Those are the allowed states. You can just point, here's one example. If I'm at the very top of the sphere where it touches this square, this point here, then I have a probability of one for getting spin up along the z direction, and I have probability half for spin x and along the plus direction, and also spin y along the plus direction. So that's consistent with what you know. Similar points pertain to each of the other points that touch the block, that touch the cube. Okay, and then you can see now the space of pure states is continuous. So I can go from any state on the sphere to any other state along a path which is continuous through the pure states.
Okay.
And that's not true here. Here I have to, in this classical system which has a finite number of possibilities, I have distinguishable states, I have to jump. So there's a difference there. Yeah, so maybe one point that's worth making before I finish. Even if you have a continuous dimensional system, so imagine you have a straight line, and you have a point here and a point here. If this is classical, then it's possible to go from point A to point B in a continuous fashion, just simply by going along these points in between.
That's something
you can do. If it's a quantum system, well, you can go continuously like this, but there's another way to go continuously from point A to point B, which exists in the kinematics, although it's not something that's physically generally happens. It's similar to what we were talking about last time, which is there exists a unitary transformation which will take you. So initially, if you're initially in the state A, just write it like that, then you can evolve to a state which is A, so alpha A plus beta B. And alpha can slowly decrease and beta can slowly increase. So all of your amplitude can be transferred continuously from A, from point A to point B. And it's continuous, but you never go through the points in between. So this will be non-local, and this kind of evolution is not physically allowed by the kinds of Hamiltonians we have in nature, but it does exist in the theory in some sense. I'm just talking about all these things because you can see here that you have this evolution through the pure states, which is what makes this possible, what makes the quantum Zeno effect possible. And it speaks to an important difference with the classical piece. Okay, so that's
everything.
I'm happy to take questions. Yeah, go ahead.
This specific shape of probabilities in quantum theory comes out from how we define norm in the Hilbert space, right?
How we define
the norm in our Hilbert space. We're defining the norm here as dot product, that's why like we get this form. But like
yeah, so you want your state to be actually, so it comes out from we want the density matrix associated with this to be, if it's a pure state, we want it to be rank one, so it only has one eigenvalue.
It doesn't have to do anything with how we define the norm.
The norm.
The norm as like size.
If you want to get the ball, then yeah, it ends up being the dot product. So yeah, it is. It is. It does come from there. So the qubit case is special in that the pure states entirely enclose the space of allowed states, whereas so for higher dimensional systems, that's no longer true. And you'll have some flat parts to the sphere. So then it's not just a sphere of some sort.
Like, I guess my original question was that, like, why we define the norm in this way to get, like, maybe we want this quantum theory to somehow look like the classical theory at some limits as well. Like, we could define another norm in some sense to get the same probabilities, or couldn't we? Like,
yeah.
Space as well, like we could define the norm instead of like dot product as, I don't know, like the absolute value of the vector.
I think we wouldn't have we'd have a different theory perhaps.
We did that.
One point about this, there is a difference between this diagram and this one, which is that here I imposed this normalization, so really we're just in here. Here there's a kind of normalization as well. You can say PZ plus PZ minus is equal to one. And I don't have this extra fourth dimension in this diagram. If I included it, what you'd have would be a sphere of a cone going down to the origin. I wasn't able to draw that. Like here you have a triangle, then a cone going back to the origin. So there's a normalization which causes this slicing to give you this triangle. That's this normalization. And that's the same normalization that gives you this ball. And then if you consider unnormalized cases, you go back along a cone to the origin.
In that case, we have six coordinates?
No, you only need four coordinates, because if this is true, then the way the theory is set up, it guarantees that PY plus py minus is equal to one as well. So you only need four coordinates for a qubit.
Could you explain again the relation between continuous evolution and quantum zero effect?
And what, sorry?
How is it related to the continuous evolution?
You can see here in the effect we just evolve a little bit, and so we take a pure state initially and we evolve it to a new pure state which is only slightly different, and that's possible. You can go from here to a state which is just slightly different. That's possible here in the pure state space. For a discrete classical system, that's not possible.
What about the measurement effect? Like, how's measurement affects to the...
So then you make a measurement back into the original basis, and then you have a very small probability of seeing anything other than the original effect, because you're actually in probability space. So you measure onto this basis, you'll just end up collapsing back to here. This is very small. This is almost equal to one.
Is it also only for the case with Hamiltonian is time independent?
I think we're considering very small time intervals here, so any time dependence wouldn't really matter. Let's see. Now, I did assume that. Let's see. I think if you did that, what would happen would be that this constant k would change successive time intervals, but it wouldn't really affect. You'd still get the same.
If k depends on time.
Mm-hmm. So let's see. So now instead of this being the sum, we would have 1 minus k during the first interval. Let me just call that 0. 1 minus and then k during the second interval, and then so on during the last interval. Okay. And then the leading term would still be the 1. It would just be basically 1 minus sum of the k's. So you'd still get the effect. Okay. So next time, which is tomorrow, because we have the makeup lecture. But I think it was, what time is it? 12:45. Tomorrow, I'm going to move on to a new subject. I'll do some quantum optics.